Welcome to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneurs Podcast. My name is Fergal Byrne. Every week, I talk to inspiring social entrepreneurs and changemakers dedicated to building a better world. Here, they tell their stories, the highs and the lows, and share what they have learned to help other social entrepreneurs and changemakers on their journeys.
Let me say this about organizations of any size, including those that have limited resources. It costs us $750,000, but the proof was so powerful that it has since drawn in 30 to 50 times that amount of resources subsequently. So it was an enormous, it had enormous return on investment for the organization, not the least of which was proving for ourselves that that the model was working. The success of any organization, be it for-profit or non-profit, does not come out of, you know, pure strategy. You don't create the winning strategy on the whiteboard. You create the winning strategy by coming up with ideas that you think have potential and getting them in front of the customer as fast as possible.
I'm very pleased today to introduce Chuck Slaughter. Chuck is founder and CEO of Living Goods, a social enterprise building a sustainable distribution platform for products designed to fight poverty and disease in the developing world. Living Goods operates networks of independent entrepreneurs currently in Uganda, Kenya, Zambia, and Myanmar, who make a living by selling medicines and other products to poor people that can help improve their health, wealth, and productivity. It uses a successful direct selling model like Avon Products. The company aims to reach 50 million people in the next 10 years with its pioneering model, and it's focusing considerable attention on sharing its model with other organizations around the world. Well, thank you very much, Chuck, for taking the time today to speak to inspiring social entrepreneurs.
I'm glad to be here.
So you have had, you wear various hats, you've worn various hats, certainly, and before coming to Living Goods, you worked in different areas as an entrepreneur. Can you talk a little bit about maybe your background and how you came to Living Goods?
I have a little bit of a winding path to the beginning of Living Goods. One of the interesting bits is that, so I'm really a private sector entrepreneur. I started a company called TravelSmith, which is a travel gear and clothing business in 1991, which I grew from scratch to over $100 million in sales, 2 million customers. And I had the good luck and good fortune to sell about 10 years ago. But that wasn't my first business. I tried a couple of things before that, all of which were disasters. And so I think if one thing informs my work in anything I do, it's that, you know, that failure is part of success and that you have to try a lot of things before you find the thing that works.
Right. That's interesting. The Living Goods, the idea in one sense, I mean, people talk about it as an Avon model. Where did you get the original idea? Can you talk a little bit about the idea and how it's evolved maybe since you first got it?
Yeah. So I had after I sold my company, I found myself having a beer with a good friend who had also sold a company, and he was funding a project in East Africa was a nonprofit operating a chain of for-profit healthcare providers, clinics and drug shops. This was in Kenya. And that idea caught my imagination, the notion of using a business model to solve a big social problem. That's really the thing that animates me, is using the tools of business to address the needs of the world. And this was in the early 2000s. And if you recall, this is about the same time that Bill Gates was turning his attention to the challenges of public health. And here seemed a pretty compelling idea. And I went over, well, actually what happened originally was my wife and I donated some money to this nonprofit. My friend Dan asked me to join the board, which I did, and then went over to see it. And I was struck by two things. Yes, a powerful idea, but also it was being very, I was having real challenges in execution. And I reported this back to the board of directors, and they asked me if I would help them do a turnaround, which I agreed to do for a period of about a year or so, year or 2 years. And here was a network of for-profit drug shops operating in rural areas in Kenya. And the observation we made was there was a lot of the day where these drug shop owners were just sitting around idly waiting for sick people to show up. And we thought, well, that's slack time. Can we put it to better use? And so we did an experiment. We got them out of their shops and into the communities, into the schools and knocking on doors. And in short, this proved to be the key element of the turnaround. These stores went from losing money to making money. And then I'm like, well, what if we took this to its logical extreme and got rid of the physical storefronts and made this just a door-to-door business? And I'm like, well, hold the phone. Isn't there somebody who's figured out this business model? And of course, one's thoughts turn to companies like Amway and Tupperware and Avon. And here's a business model that's been around since the 19th century. Avon started in 1876. It's a $160 billion industry today. It's growing faster than the big consumer goods businesses. Very profitable. And I thought, well, imagine if you could harness the power of that business model to sell not just discretionary products like lipstick, but things people really need, like treatments for malaria and diarrhea and healthy food. And that was the moment of inspiration, if you will. And Living Goods began as trying to answer that question. Could you adapt that model to providing high quality healthcare to the poor?
Right. Well, we can talk a little bit more about that adoption of the model and how you, you know, developed it and made a success of it. But you touched on a very interesting question, which comes up again and again in various different guises, which is about this question. I mean, social entrepreneurship at its heart is this idea really of using business to meet social needs. Can you talk a little bit about why you think the benefit of doing that, and maybe in the context of what you saw, that, you know, how a non-business orientation, you know, might not have helped you? And what is it about that business orientation, do you think, crucially, that allows it to work, to be more powerful, and certainly in certain situations?
So first of all, I come from a school of thought that believes that there's not as much difference between the sectors as we believe or pretend. That, you know, whether you're a company, a government, or a nonprofit, your purpose is to serve your customer. And if you really start with that as the premise and say, what does my customer need? How can I bring some creativity to serving those needs, to bring them better products and services at a lower cost? It's really the same question across the sectors. I went to the Yale School of Management, and that was sort of the founding philosophy of the school, is that we're going to teach management without regard to sector. You know, marketing is marketing. Finance is finance. I think that's the mentality. If you focus, it's really about, as I said, it's about focusing on the customer. And, you know, I think, you know, if you're going to compare and contrast the sectors, I suppose what you find wanting sometimes in the business and nonprofit sectors is less discipline in doing those things really well, less focus on innovation, less focus on performance management. And I think, you know, if there's a structural challenge, it's that the social sectors, because of the absence of the absolute focus on the bottom line, it's more difficult to create a clear sense of accountability end to end. And that's been a big part of the journey at Living Goods, is how do you create great performance management and the same level of accountability that you find in the private sector, in the social sector. And one focus for us in that regard is really getting into what our end goal is and having great research and evidence to support it. So from day one at Living Goods, we wanted a measure that was as clear and powerful to us and to our funders as profit is to an investor in a private business. And so for that reason, we invested in doing a randomized control study to measure the impact of Living Goods on its effect on saving children's lives. And that was, for those of your listeners know what a randomized study is. They're big, they're complicated, but they're the best way to prove impact in the social sector. And I did that initially because I wanted to be sure for myself that what we were doing was having the impact that we intended. I didn't want to be wasting my time. And it that investment in evidence, in research, in focusing on really delivering for the customer, and using the best research to prove it, has become a core principle for us. And I think has helped bridge that gap, if you will. So we have something that gets closer to the clarity of the bottom line.
Right. So this randomized study, what exactly does that look like? How difficult is it to do? And what about smaller organizations that might not have the resources? Or what is the resource commitment? Or if you are in a resource-strained environment, what do you suggest? I packed in a few questions there, Charles.
Yeah, it's obviously very contextual. So it depends on what you're trying to measure. We happen to be trying to measure something that's very challenging, which is child mortality. So to measure that, you need very big study. So we surveyed 215 villages and took 8,000 household surveys to do this. And the good news for us was the result was very powerful. We hoped to get a 10 to 12% reduction in child mortality. The result showed us that we were getting a 25% reduction in child deaths, a 7% reduction in stunting. We helped show that we could drive counterfeit drugs out of the market. So it was very powerful. It was expensive. It cost us $750,000. But let me say this about organizations of any size, including those that have limited resources. It cost us $750,000. But the proof was so powerful that it has since drawn in 30 to 50 times that amount of resources subsequently. So it was an enormous return on investment for the organization, not the least of which was proving for ourselves that the model was working. But RCTs aren't the only way to prove impact, and I would just encourage your listeners to seek out the best sort of partners in research. And we happen to work with two great organizations. One is called Innovations for Poverty Action, which is a Yale spinoff. Another one called the Poverty Action Lab, which comes out of MIT. Organizations like that can advise you on, what's the most cost-efficient method to prove the impact that you're after.
That's an amazing finding, Chuck. As you say, gives you really good confidence that you're, heading in the right direction, that you're having an impact. How confident were you? And what stage in the process were you? How long and were you on the journey before you felt confident enough or just when you actually did it? Because presumably, you can do these impact studies, but if you're not very confident that you've got, all your ducks lined up, that can be a problem.
So it's interesting question. We were very confident we were having an impact. But we were not very confident that the study was going to show it. And that sounds a lot, but RCTs are hard to do. They're hard to design. The way you ask the questions, the way you do the randomization, all these things can affect whether it actually reveals an impact or not. And without going into all the detail, it was due to the complexity and, we're working in Uganda, in rural Uganda, and getting quality answers is a tricky thing to do. One thing we did that helped was, this was a 3.5 year study, was we took sort of a midpoint dipstick study about a year into this. And that quickly showed us that there was some problems with the study design. And it also showed us operationally which portions of our thing seemed to be working better and which were not working as well. So that sort of a quick look in the study without waiting the full 3 years allowed us to both improve the study design and make some operational changes, the result of which was the great outcome we saw at the end. It's part of, I think it fits into our broader sort of philosophy of the organization, which is the most important thing we do is to try to learn fast. To make mistakes on small money and small investments of time rather than make grand investments over a long period, only to find out years later that you were on the wrong track.
Yes. So innovation, is that what you're talking about here? And I know you talk about rapid experimentation. Or what stage were you in the business when you really started to, get behind that and start to see some results? And what are a couple of things you might have learned about making a success?
So this is really part one of our guiding principles. The TravelSmith, the company started as a direct marketing business, and it is direct marketing businesses are very data driven and very testing oriented. So we're always testing one thing against another, one headline against another, one list against another, one marketing idea against another, one, et cetera. And so that philosophy of trying a lot of things to see what works is just is second nature to me and became a sort of founding philosophy for Living Goods. And again, I think that's sometimes lacking in the social sector. My view is that, the success of any organization, be it for profit or nonprofit, does not evolve, does not come out of, pure strategy. You don't create the winning strategy on the whiteboard. You create the winning strategy by coming up with ideas that you think have potential and getting them in front of the customer as fast as possible. I like what I'm an admirer of the founder of Intuit. It's a company that created QuickBooks. It's got 80% market share in the accounting software business. And he says he likes his product managers to be coming up with ideas that can be high value proposition to the customer that he can put in front of the customer in 2 weeks and learn from them and change, evolve his product from those kind of tests. So that's the kind of philosophy we try to lean into is don't try to create a strategy from whole cloth. Come up with good ideas, test them as quickly as possible. And importantly, know when to walk away from something that isn't working. I think that's a problem I see in the social sector is that people get very quickly get stuck on ideas and find themselves doing the same thing in the same way, even if it doesn't appear to be effective.
What have you found about rapid experimentation in that sense? What are the obstacles to stopping projects or stopping ideas that aren't working?
It's really comes back to people. The success of any enterprise is all about the people. The challenge is creating a culture where failure is considered part of the path to winning. And so that people don't feel bad when they walk away from something. And very publicly saying, we're going to stop doing, we tried that, we're going to stop it. We tried that, we're going to stop doing that. And people seeing that that's part of how you do business. So they're both encouraged to try things and they're not discouraged when something doesn't work. And you have to walk the talk. You have to actually reward people who do that. You have to hold them up as examples. You got to pay them well. It's the intersection of the people, that philosophy and how you manage people.
Right. You talk about this performance management. Can you talk a little bit about the journey that you went on in terms of, maybe how some of the goals that you were articulating one stage when you really refined them, when you started to think about them and, this performance management focus, how would they have changed? I mean, just generally, what is the difference between, fuzzy goals or and the kind of goals you need to get the kind of performance that you're talking about?
So, I'm a this will sound a little bit obvious, but very, very powerful believer in clear, crisp, measurable goals. For example, when we do, most companies do performance reviews at the end of the years, at end of each year. We don't call it a review, we call it a performance plan. And the focus of the plan is not so much the looking backward piece, it's looking forward. Setting very clear, measurable targets for the year ahead. And I guess, so this is part of how we operated from the beginning. A big change came for us about 2 years ago when we decided to invest significantly in mobile technology to support our ability to track performance. Even though I came from a business that was an online, you know, when I, by the time I sold it, TravelSmith was majority an online business. Technology had not been a centerpiece for Living Goods until a few years ago. Part of that was because the penetration of mobile phones and access to a signal was growing during the time that we started living, we're building Living Goods. So when we started the company, only about 30% of the population had a phone. About by 3 years ago, though, we realized that 70 to 80% of the people in Uganda had a phone, and the signal was available almost everywhere in the country. So we took a big, we made a big bet, a big experiment to put smartphones in the hands of all, 4,000 of our health entrepreneurs. In brief, this turned out to be a very, very powerful experiment. We did it quick and dirty in-house. We showed that it could work, and then we rolled it out to the entire organization. And now, this system allows us to, every agent collects every single interaction they have with a customer. Every time we treat a child, register a pregnancy, follow up with a sick kid, all that data is collected on our Smart Health app. And anybody in the organization, the field managers, the regional managers, the country management, all the way up to my office in San Francisco, can see the performance of any one of those 4,000 agents in real time on any device. And so that dramatically sped up the feedback of information about what was working and what wasn't, and which agents were thriving and which weren't. And so over this last 2 years, we've gone from an organization where technology, I think, was considered a bit of an accessory to one where it's really the backbone, the motherboard, if you will, of the organization. And that's been a challenging transition. Developing software and managing a large, complex technology system was not a core competence for the organization. And that's a hard thing to do, is to take an organization and build a new core competency. We're 2.5 years into this now, and now other organizations around the world are coming to us who want to replicate this system. So we now support three of the largest NGOs in the world are replicating the Living Goods model, and all of them are interested in one form or another in adapting the this mobile sort of performance management tool to their different contexts.
That's a great result. That's a great result. You've got 4,000 agents. Can you talk a little bit about the agents and what kind of background and how they find the experience and what it's been like getting putting together a network that you have?
Yeah. So just a little background, what do they do? So our agents, so this is again built on the Avon model. They're independent entrepreneurs. They're not paid staff. They earn a margin on the products that they sell. They also earn occasionally small sort of incentives that we give for specific impact results we want, like registering a pregnancy. So they're motivated, they're driven, they tend to be very, we look for people who are gregarious, who are involved, who have strong sort of social networks. I often say that Avon was the original social network idea, a business that uses people's social networks as the means of marketing, if you will. And by the way, figured out how to monetize it quickly. And so they go door to door, teaching people how to improve their health, and they make a living selling high-impact, low-cost health products like treatments for malaria, diarrhea, pneumonia, healthy fortified foods, clean birthing kits, solar lighting, high-efficiency cook stoves, these sorts of products. And they work in poor communities in Uganda, in Kenya, with our partners in Zambia, in Myanmar. These are families who live on, each person is living on $1 to $2 a day. And the key thing is that they are known and trusted people in their community. The customer knows that they can call this woman any time of day or night. The Living Goods agent will come to their home. This is really a lot about convenience. they'll provide a treatment that works, that's reliable. They know their kid's going to get better. And so it's really, a lot of this is about the trust between the agent and her customer. The beautiful thing that we see that really inspires me is that the women who thrive at this, and I think this is the, you know, what's powerful about the social sector in general, the women who thrive at this are women who both, you know, are driven to make a living, but who are also driven to make a difference. That's where the great success comes from, is that, you know, that sort of passion to build a great small business, but also to do it for a reason, because they want to serve their friends, their family, and their community better. Those are our greatest agents, you know, combine those two ideals.
It's fantastic. PopTech has been catalyzing social impact for two decades via its renowned fellows program, incubated initiatives, thought-provoking salons and conferences. The PopTech 2017 conference takes place October 19th to 21st. You can book tickets now and find out more information at poptech.org.
And what would the alternatives be to the people in the village who buy these products? To what extent, I mean, you're selling these, so presumably they need to value this. This is scarce money that they have. Is there an educational element? And, you know, how does that work?
So, you know, I always start with what's the value proposition to the customer. That's, by the way, that's whether you're talking about your end customer or an investor or a funder or a partner, you know, what value you're bringing to them. And so just to give you put in context, the average treatment that we sell costs about 50 cents. And the value proposition is powerful because of the door-to-door business model. So you ask, what's the alternative? So for half to two-thirds of our customers, the alternative is spending, you know, a half a day to a day walking to a public health center where, in theory, they can get a medicine for free. The governments tend to offer these medicines for free. But this is going to cost them up to a dollar in transportation costs in each direction. So the 50-cent drug delivered to your door is actually cheaper than free. It's cheaper than the free medicine that would take you a half a day and $2 in transport costs to access from a government center. And plus, you're going to get treated faster, which means it's much less likely your kid is going to become severely ill. And, you know, and you're avoiding, you know, missed labor and losing, you know, potentially productive income. So even though, you know, again, the government often offers these services for free, this sort of for-profit model is offering a better value proposition to the end customer.
Right. And is education required?
So, you know, this is why I always think this is funny, this quote-unquote question about education. Of course, that's true of any product. You know, people often get hung up on language. In the business sector, you call it marketing. In the social sector, they call it education or behavior change. You know, yeah. Every great company is trying to change the behavior of their target customer to buy their product. It's a matter of how good you are at it. And so, yes, every great door-to-door salesperson is an educator, is a teacher, is a salesperson, is a convincer, a handholder. And we work in a hard space. I mean, getting people to change their behavior about what they eat, what medicines they take, that's hard to do, which is why this business model is so well suited, because, you know, as I said, the Avon model is all about the trust between the seller and the buyer. And the fact that the model is built on educating and selling to people who know you already and who trust you already, that's the power of this model. And by the way, look at the rise of social media. It's built on the same, you know, idea of leveraging the power of human connections, and so we're all feeding off the same power source, if you will.
Yes, I've had limited experience, but in there has been some network marketing you come across in the UK, and there is a resistance to people feeling that their social relationships are monetized, or they're getting contacted by people who are, you know, friends, but, you know, organize them to come around, and they feel under pressure to buy things. It's a different scenario, presumably, because these are health products that are, you know, necessary. In but are there any sociocultural issues like that?
So yeah, I mean, yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head. This, these, you know, the mother who's calling our agent is the mother of a child who's has a high fever and sick with malaria, or who's pregnant and is experiencing some distressing sign in her pregnancy. So she desperately needs someone who can come to her quickly and who she trusts. So this, we have very, very little resistance. One thing you occasionally see is part of the big problem we're solving for is increasing the number of trained professionals in the health sector. So, you know, 80% of the people who we train have no prior health experience. And so in the beginning, you know, actually a challenge you have is that, you know, this is a neighbor, you know, a living goods agent before may have had a business, you know, raising chickens or tailoring. And so in the beginning, they sometimes have resistance from their neighbors saying, geez, you were tailoring yesterday and you're a nurse today. You know, I'm not sure if I'm going to trust you. But that trust turns out gets built up very quickly, particularly the first time you go to treat a child and that child gets better. That happens very quickly. And I could share dozens of stories with you. And the technology helps, by the way. Interestingly, we found that putting the smartphone in the hands of this woman increases her credibility with her neighbors.
Yeah.
You know, she gets training, she gets a certificate, she gets this smartphone. The smartphone, by the way, has a automated diagnosis tool in it. So we built an algorithm-based app that helps ensure that the agent gets the diagnosis, asks the right questions in the right order to get the right diagnosis every time.
Yes. Well, I was going to ask about that. Is there a question? Well, what your best-selling products are, but also, is there a question about, because health needs are limitless, I suppose, and, you know, how do you know where to stop, or, you know, how do you define the area that you're going to, you know, be able to help with?
It's really interesting. So so one is there's clearly a boundary. There's, you know, we're really training the agents to know what they are permitted and trained to do and what they're not. And so there's a very robust system of referral. When they diagnose the child at the end of the diagnosis process, the app will give a message saying whether this is a child should be referred to a physician, to a health center. And then when you get to the end of that questionnaire, we see the result through this mobile system. And so we know that that child should be referred, and we know to follow up with the agent to make sure the child got seen by a professional. So knowing where that bright line is very important. But here's an interesting thing, which is that to fill this enormous gap in health professionals, the technology is really a game changer. And what we've been with the help of the technology, by providing more accurate diagnosis and better trackability, greater transparency, we've been able to persuade the regulators in these countries to authorize these community-based agents to do more and more complex, sophisticated tasks, you know, like prescribing an antibiotic or doing a blood test in the field. Those are things we couldn't do 5 years ago, but we've won permission from the governments in East Africa to do them because we're putting better technology in the hands of the agent and because we have better visibility on every result. So that was a bit of an unforeseen benefit of investing in the technology.
It's a great result. That's, yeah. Because you see that people talking about that more here in Western health as well. I mean, I don't know what they call it, de-skilling or what, but certainly like nurses doing more sophisticated other work that they mightn't have done before, which allows, you know, doctors to focus on other kinds of issues and things. Can you tell me, what's the scale of your activity at the moment, Chuck? And broadly speaking, how did it, you know, evolve?
So as of the end of 2016, we are serving 5 million people principally across Uganda and Kenya. And to put that in context, that's as many people as live in Ireland or Norway or Liberia. It's virtually, we're providing healthcare for a small country. We grew gradually up till about 3 years ago. 3 years ago, we were serving about 1 million people. In the last 2.5 years, we've gone under a very rapid expansion, which was triggered by the success of that study. It was, you know, having that clear, independent, high-quality proof unlocked a wave of interest from funders, from talent, from partners in government. I can't overemphasize how powerful and transformational that research has been for us. So much so that actually we're investing in a second RCT, a randomized study, right now. So we're on a rapid growth path. Our goal now is to reach 50 million people. We want to get to national scale. We want to become the national system in Uganda and Kenya, each of which are countries of 30 to 40 million people. And we want to replicate it in at least 3 more countries. So this is, we're talking about potentially, you know, we're providing healthcare to over 50 million people, primary healthcare. The powerful thing that's happening right now, you know, part of the journey is how this thing is getting financed. In the beginning, and up till fairly recently, this was financed in an unusual way. So, unlike most nonprofits, I come from a business background. I really wanted to fund this like a business. So the majority of the financing for Living Goods up to this point has come from fellow successful entrepreneurs who share, you know, the vision for using business principles to solve challenging needs in healthcare. So these are people like Piero Midyar, founder of eBay, Bill Draper, one of the famous founding icons in venture capital, Chris Hahn, one of the most successful hedge fund managers in Europe, and people of this nature. So that has provided us this sort of very smart, flexible, large-scale funding to get to the place that we are. But now to take this to the next level, to bring it to a scale of countries and regions, we need to really also begin partnering much more deeply with the local governments and with the biggest funders in healthcare, which of course are not just the local governments, but the big donor countries like, you know, US, UK, global institutions like the World Bank, the Global Fund, et cetera. And so going forward, our vision is to bring the same level of creativity and ingenuity to financing as we have to delivery. And so, you know, you've heard me say that Living Goods really is a performance-based organization, performance-based culture. Everybody, so the agents are paid for results, and everybody inside the organization is paid for performance. So that's sort of a core philosophy. Get paid for your results. And now we're going to take that to the organizational level. So we're designing a pay-for-results mechanism as a way for funders to invest in this platform overall. So we're seeking to raise $100 million now from a combination of high-net-worth individuals and governments and large institutions. And the notion is you only will pay Living Goods once we prove we've delivered the outputs that were that we've proved over the last 10 years. So at the end of a quarter or a year, we'll report out via this mobile system how many pregnant women we served, how many children we treated. And based on those metrics, we'll get paid by the funders. So getting paid after the fact for results, not before the fact for to finance inputs, if you will. We think this would be a revolutionary way to fund a nonprofit. And a way to dramatically lower the risk for the funder. So it virtually eliminates the executional risk for the funder. And we think that will be a means to attract a lot more money to the idea.
Wow, that's a big idea, a transformational idea. Can you give me some idea of the kind of investment that you needed to get the business to this stage? How long did it take before it was making a profit?
Well, so... good question. So let me share a couple thoughts here. One is I'm a very big believer on testing on the cheap. And so, in general, we try to, you know, our mandate to our team is think of ideas that have good potential for enormous impact or improvement in our sustainability, but that you can test relatively quickly and cheaply. So that's sort of the philosophy. To get to the stage that we had the proof from the RCT took, I'm trying to think now, so that we started in about 2008, and the RCT results came out in 2009. So that, you know, the whole process actually took 6 or 7 years, and the entire investment up to that point, I'm going to ballpark, cumulatively, was probably about $10 and $15 million. We've since raised 2 or 3 times that that amount. And just to clarify, this is a nonprofit that uses a business model. The organization overall doesn't turn a profit. The agents make a profit. We recover 100% of cost of the product, which just in those two levels solves two gigantic problems in public health, which is how do you pay health workers and how do you finance the medicines? Additionally, the system throws off contribution a margin that pays a fair amount of the distribution cost, but not all of it. But this is an insane value proposition. So if you're a government, if you're a USAID or a high net worth funder, this model provides the impact that I described at a net cost of just $2 per person per year. So, you know, in the US, we spend about $8,000 a year per person on healthcare. The top 5 European countries spend about $4,000 or $5,000 a year. And so we're talking about a $2 a year per investment that takes an enormous bite out of mortality for the highest risk populations in some of the poorest places. It's an insane value proposition in healthcare. And in fact, we think we can take it from $2 down to $1 as we grow and scale.
That's an extraordinary result. Yeah. Before I talk briefly about scaling, I'm mindful of the time. I just wanted to ask you, what did I want to ask you? I need to note these kind of things. Yes. Why did you choose to be a non-profit? Was there a moment when you thought about being a profit, or was it a very clear decision?
This is an interesting question about what form of organization, nonprofit, for-profit. And, you know, for your listeners, of course, there's no one right answer. It's entirely depends on the context. And my own view is that that most of the sectors, you can have, you know, a combination of impact and financial success functioning as a legal entity that's either a for-profit or a nonprofit. Let me make an interesting sort of semantic point about healthcare, which is that to a certain degree, I don't think it matters. You know, in the United States, there are no large healthcare companies that wouldn't exist without some form of government payment. You know, and this is true in most economies, is that whether you're a pharmaceutical company, a hospital chain, a diagnostics company, you know, you wouldn't exist if it weren't for Medicaid and Medicare or the National Institutes of Health investing in, investing or paying the cost for many of your beneficiaries, many of your customers. And it's no different in the place we work, if not more so. We're trying to serve a much, much poorer customer. And we don't have, you know, these countries don't have Medicare, Medicaid, and NIH. They have USAID and the World Bank. Living goods, put another way, I think it could easily be either a nonprofit or a for-profit. The mechanism I described to you before of this pay-for-results mechanism could come in the form of grant payments, or it could come in the form of contract payments. And the difference is, and again, in my view, is fairly a linguistic one rather really than a terribly practical one. I think if we look cast forward over the next decade, I think it's likely that living goods, that iterations of living goods in different places, whether they're run by us or run by partners, could be set up either as for-profits, as non-profits, as for-profits, or as, you know, government initiatives, if you will. My point is, I wouldn't get too hung up on the legal question.
Right. Does it make a difference internally? I mean, I've spoken to social entrepreneurs that came from a charity background, turned their charities into, you know, for profits, and they had real challenges on this journey, how they talked about profits, how they thought about and motivated employees in your organization, since you're a non-profit, but yet you talk about these very clear guidelines and targets and goals and things. Is that something you've had to think about?
You made an interesting distinction. If, you know, for us, it hasn't been an issue because we were purpose built to run this way. So most of the people we hire, for example, this, as I said, this all comes back to people. We hire primarily from the private sector, not from the social sector. And most of the agents are women who've run their own small businesses. So we haven't had to, you know, work too hard to change people's mentality about yes. thinking and working like a business.
Yes.
Now, if you're an existing nonprofit and you're trying to transform into a social enterprise, that's a much harder thing to do.
Yes.
It's nearly impossible. My advice generally is to have, if you want to do that, you really have to set up a separate entity and hire new people for it with a separate governance. And start building management from scratch. Some people can make the conversion, but you're pulling against the tide of institutional norms that can be decades old.
Absolutely. And finally, then maybe just about scaling, because on the face of it, it's a pretty labor-intensive operation. I mean, I know you talked about these major technological initiatives, but you're building a network of people. How big an issue has it been? How have you thought about scaling? And presumably that's changing looking forward. But talk a little bit about your philosophy of scaling.
Yeah, so that, you know, there's this question that always gets asked in the social sector. Geez, there's so many successful ideas that are proven to have results, but that fail to scale. You know, sometimes called pilotitis. It's always been kind of a head scratcher to me. Something that really works should be able to scale. I think where organizations fail is on two levels. One is in designing their systems and designing their performance management systems and hiring with a view to scale. So what do I mean by that? One is, one philosophy I've had from the beginning is always hire the best possible people. Hire a bigger person than you think you need today, because for sure you're going to need them tomorrow. So the person who, if you hire just to serve the needs of the organization today, that person is not going to be able to grow your organization. So, you know, if I think I need a manager, I hire a director. If I think I need a director, I'm going to hire a vice president, so that your people can scale with you as you grow your entity. We also make a big point in Living Good. This sounds like a small thing, but makes a big difference in scaling, is we hire 6 to 9 months ahead of the need. So we've tripled in scale in the last 2.5 years. The only way we've been able to do that is hiring the people we need to run new branches and locations 6 to 9 months ahead of time, and giving them, you know, at least 6 months to train on the job before they take charge of a new territory or region. If you look at great, you know, retailers, so I come from the retail world, you know, they have two entirely separate operations, you know, one that runs the day-to-day of operations, the other one that's focused on growth. And again, many nonprofits don't think that way. So hiring ahead of the curve is big. And then, as I've said a couple times, the mobile and digital tools have been transformational. So, you know, it's much easier to manage a workforce of 5 to 10,000 people if you've got these mobile tools that give you visibility in real time. If you're relying just on paper, that's nearly impossible. So nonprofits working, you know, even in difficult places like East Africa, you know, the technology can be, you know, provide a tremendous amount of lubrication when it comes to scaling faster with less risk.
Right. Very interesting. Chuck, that's been a action-packed podcast. That's been fascinating. Lots of really good insights and useful information for other social entrepreneurs, and a really powerful vision and a great work that you've done. So thank you so much for your time today, Chuck, and I wish you the very best of success in the future.
Virgil, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Inspiring Social Entrepreneur podcast. I hope you found this interview inspiring. Please make sure to visit www.inspiringsocialentrepreneurs.com and subscribe to make sure you don't miss any future podcasts.